So I want to welcome everyone to Amravati this afternoon. Yeah, today with the shocking news about Princess Diana, I feel a strong sense of tragedy and sadness. And surprising, my own reaction, I didn't even know her. But just the death of somebody like that has quite an emotional impact. So it's just like with mindfulness we can contemplate this experience of that we all have in our lives as human beings. This experience of loss, even of somebody that isn't, we may not know personally, but you know them through the press or through various other means. So they do affect our lives. And sometimes we can live in a world that's very much thinking kind of enclosed in our own little family with our own little group. But when you really contemplate the way things are, you recognize that we're all in the same boat or on the same planet, in the same universe, that our lives are not isolated, unrecognized experiences like they might seem. And that in our own way we affect the world and the universe that we're living in. And so the Buddhist attitude of to do good and refrain from doing evil with bodily action and speech is one way of taking on responsibility so that our lives in this universe are, say, not intentionally causing harm to some other creature. But inevitably, in life, we have to experience loss and grief in a highly personal way or through just being belonging to this human family. And that gives us a chance to really recognize the impermanent nature of this realm, that it is about loss. That life as a human individual is the experience of loss, gain and loss, until the death of the body. And so in meditation, is a kind of intentionally giving up everything, losing everything, till that what remains is the deathless, so that we realize the deathless, because if we don't, if we're heedless and live in just a habitual way, then we, even though the deathless is ever present reality for us, we don't notice it. We're so caught up in just maybe the endless desires to experience happiness or security or pleasure. Excitement, interest, fascination. The whole our society very much is involved in this at this time, isn't it? Endless variety of possibilities or just exciting, interesting experiences that modern technology make available to us. We don't even have the restraints of kind of ethics or morals anymore to hold us back, or social pressure, isn't it? It's more or less just do whatever you feel like. So that there is this incredible kind of freedom to do whatever interests, fascinates, excites you, or to seek. We also have the freedom to restrain ourselves or become Buddhist monks or not. It's, There's not a big kind of line, big queue for that one. So in the subject, the name of the talk is Why Worry? And of course worry is a common problem we all have. When you start thinking, you start worrying. I think when you don't think very much, you don't worry very much, because you have to think. You know, when you think about things, then you end up worrying about them. Because the future is the unknown, isn't it? We don't know exactly. We can kind of hope and expect, anticipate what might happen in the future, but we don't know, and so even though we might hope that everything's going to go well and everything's going to be hunky-dory in the future, it might not. There's better worry about it. Might get terrible diseases or lose all your hair or I worried so much about that, I just shaved it all off. So like Princess Diana, the future, isn't it? We thought she's got a long life ahead of her, doing all kinds of good things, helping others and so forth. So then suddenly life cut short, and it's a big shock because we didn't expect, we didn't expect her death. If she were in riddled with disease or very old or something, it wouldn't be such a shock. But especially when some young people or die, it is a big shock. When you get old, then you kind of expect it. People still get shocked even when they get old, because death is something that we generally ignore or don't really try to understand, but just kind of regard it as something that you're not polite to discuss it in decent society. But we do worry, isn't it? I hear people say, I don't mind how I die. I mean, I don't mind, I'm not afraid of death, but it's just that I dread, worry about maybe it'll be a long, drawn-out, prolonged kind of misery where, I lose my faculties, become incontinent, I have to go to some terrible nursing home, and the slow, dreary, ugly process of pain and humiliation until the death moment. Death doesn't sound so bad. It's the worry about the possibilities that might happen before that moment. Or we can worry about what happens when we die. That's another thing people can worry about, because we don't know. So it's just like when somebody commits suicide. A friend of mine committed suicide, and people would ask, well, what happens when, what do Buddhists believe when somebody commits suicide? Do they have to have some kind of punishment, or is it morally wrong, or is it, what happens, what do Buddhists believe? And the thing is, we don't know. I don't know. What happens when somebody dies? I haven't died yet. But this knowing then is a way to relate to life, is by knowing that the unknown is the unknown. Death is something that will happen. We know it will happen. But when, we don't know, and What happens after you're dead, we don't know. So we know that we don't know. Suicide, one can think. And you can speculate all kinds of moral issues about suicide, about whether it's murder, self-murder, whether it should be punished, by the judge, by some judgmental force in the afterlife, or what? Don't know. And this isn't like a lazy way of getting out of tricky situations. But it is recognizing the way it is, that we don't know. And that, but we can know that we don't know. We can know that right now, it's like this. We know what life is like in a human form. We know what consciousness is like. Consciousness is like this, isn't it? Sensitivity is like this. We feel that we're in a sensitive state, so we feel things. When we hear the news, Princess Diana died in a crash. He was killed. Was killed. That's even more powerful, isn't it? Died, but was killed in a crash. I mean, those are words, but they do affect us because the sensitivity is like this. Sensitivity means that we feel things. We aren't just. If you say it to the door or something, it doesn't probably doesn't feel anything. Say it to another human being, especially if they understand your language and they know who you're talking about, you feel something. So we can observe sensitivity, we can be aware that what sensitivity is like when through the sight, through sound, smell, taste, touch, thought. Breathing, we're breathing, we're feeling, we're thinking, we have memory, so we can remember Princess Diana, remember her, that's a memory. So memory we can be aware of as what, and we can see it also in terms of experience, the memory makes us feel something. Which can be either pleasant, painful, or indifferent. And then there's the silence. We can be aware of emptiness and space, consciousness, silence in the present, because these all exist now in the present. So when we bring our attention into the present, mindfulness, then we are at that point of what we can actually know without grasping ideas about things or coming from a position that somebody else gives us, some doctrinal position, some belief, some dogma, some statement or some theory or some speculation. So this direct knowing is what the Buddha was pointing to as the way to develop wisdom in our lives, so that if we don't do this, then we go by hearsay, by habits, by cultural attitudes, by prejudices, by conditioning, by emotional reactivity, and we're caught up in all that. So we can get very confused and very insecure by that, by not knowing quite what we should be thinking, or how we should be feeling, or how we should see something. So people do ask, they want to know, what should I believe in? What should I think? What should I do with my life? And so we tend to sometimes seek that in somebody else, somebody who says, I know how you should live your life, and I can tell you what happens when you die, and if I can tell you what you should do with your life, and what you should be, what you should think. And many people will follow these cults, isn't it? Cult behavior usually draws people who want to be attached to somebody that's confident and that will tell them what to do, what to think, what to believe in. We get accused of being a cult because we look like a cult. So we get tarred with the same brush, the cult brush. I think we're the same as the Moonies, the same as the Hare Krishna, the same as the Jonestown. Remember that about 20 years ago? And they think we're the same as Waco, Texas, or whatever. I think I'm probably some kind of demonic guru. Lures innocent boys and girls into the web and then trap them with belief. But I don't. Because in terms of Dhamma, then you're trying to awaken people, not trying to get power over them and try to control them or use them in any way. The aim of the Buddha was this awakenness, to awaken yourself. So the word Buddha means the awakened one, to be awake and aware, to know things as they are. So what I say this afternoon is for reflection. It's not telling you that you should do this or think like this or be a Buddhist or believe anything I say this afternoon. You can, or at any time, but it is for reflection, for awakening, for contemplation. Worry is always about the unknown, isn't it? And you can always, that's why we can always worry. Even when everything's going right, everything's right on, everything's on time, everything's going well. Because we recognize that you can't, that very seldom can you sustain that kind of momentum to where, through a whole lifetime, where everything just gets better and better, better and better, better and better, until you die, unless you die very young. Because even then it's hard to sustain it, you know, just the sense of things are going to be permanently well, permanently all right. Because this realm that we live in is like this, it's uncertain, it's in basically, you know, it's in nature's insecurity. That's just because that's the way it is. It's not a complaint against life, but we're just noticing that this is the way it is. So when we contemplate in this way, we don't expect life to be a secure experience, a constant experience of just life getting better and better and making us feel good and everything feeling all right, everything being okay. Because we know that life is going to give us some hard knocks, going to give us some difficult things to deal with in life. And one of these, of course, is loss. I think that's one of the things we, you know, dread the most, is losing something, somebody or something that we love or are very dependent upon. The sense of loss. You can see like the two princes, Diana's son, they're experiencing grief or loss of their mother. Now they're experiencing it at a very young age. I was in my 50s when that happened, when my mother and father died, and they died of old age. Rather than of a car accident. I mean, though I was quite prepared for the loss, but in spite of the preparation and the meditation and the understanding, you still feel it. Loss is like this. And you don't not feel life as you meditate. You just begin to feel, you're more willing to feel and experience life in all its aspects. So when my parents died, I did feel the loss. But I could totally accept that feeling. I could completely embrace that feeling. Reflect upon it, because it was present. It was what I was actually feeling at the time. This emotion called grief, loss of the loved. It's like this. So the grief was then something that you instead of just dismissing or rejecting or wallowing in, something you learn from your observing. Your feeling, by observing, you're not being kind of cold-heartedly indifferent to the feeling. You're totally embracing it. You're actually feeling it totally, completely for what it is. And then through that, then of course you experience its cessation. So you're aware of the impermanent nature of grief and that it's a condition that arises in life. When the conditions are there, when these particular things come together, then this is what one is feeling. And so this is why we contemplate and reflect on life rather than try to arrange it, control it, manipulate conditions to protect ourselves from experiencing grief or loss or despair or old age, sickness, death, or disease. Worry is something that I've learned a lot from observing worry. It isn't like I just said, I'm not going to worry anymore, and I don't do it. But, I mean, I have said that, but it doesn't stop me from worrying. So instead of trying to stop worrying, when there's worry, then I acknowledge it. Worry is like this. I study, I observe, I feel it. I accept this sense of worriedness, of feeling this kind of mental agitation. I don't know what's going to happen. What if this happens? What if everything goes wrong? What if it all collapses? What if this person dies? Oh, I don't know what I'll do. But that kind of feeling is something that if it's what one is experiencing now, then it's something you use as your practice, as you're developing the path. Sometimes you think developing the path means we get rid of worry first, and then once we get rid of worry, then we develop the path. And that's not how I experience it. The developing the path isn't like not experiencing worry, but you see the path once you get rid of those emotions, but in being able to recognize those emotions. Use those emotions for the path, because this realm that we live in is like this. There's a lot to worry about on the personal level. The future is unknown since I can remember. Remember after the Second World War. Remember the euphoria a child then, the euphoria, the end of the Second World War. Because we used to worry about what if they invaded? You know, I was on the west coast of the United States. We used to worry about the Germans invading. Or Japanese. So we... I remember we used to have these... air raid drills in school, and we'd all have to go down into the cellar of the school and crouch down. And I thought it was exciting. Some children get very upset, you know, found it very Then I found out one way of dealing with it. If you live close enough to the school, they let you go home. Well, I didn't live all that close, but I told them I did, and then I could get to go home. Use it as a day off. So I look forward to these air raid drills. But then, after the Second World War, then what happened was the Russians. Immediately, that started worrying about the Third World War. I remember we started immediately worrying about the Third World War. Once the Second World War was over. And we worried about that up until recently. And then there's always worrying about the pound or the dollar, isn't it? When it goes up or down or right or left, backwards or forwards, the economy and the relationships with other countries and relationships with other people and the state of affairs, the decadence of the society, drugs and moral laxity and crime and now I've got so many things to worry about. Drugs and all that. A lot of we didn't worry about drugs when I was a child. No, we didn't. There wasn't a problem then. Nobody worried about it. Now parents worry about their children becoming Buddhist monks and nuns. But my parents never worried about that till I actually became one. That was not even an option. That wasn't even a, you know, conscious option in their. In their menu of options, drug addict was more possible than Buddhist monk. And then we worry about our children and about our spouses and about everything. So I mean, because you don't know what's going to happen or how they'll turn out, or because the future is always the unknown. So in meditation, this unknowingness, instead of trying to just prop yourself up with positive ideas, everything's going to be all right. Everything will be okay. That kind of helps sometimes to kind of lessen the anxiety about the future. We like to be told, you know, when politicians, clever politicians, or even not so clever ones, tell you that everything's going to be all right, everything's going to be okay, because it makes us feel good, because we don't know. Who'd vote for somebody that said everything's going to get worse? Now let's contemplate right now to say the future is the unknown. Not knowing is an experience right now, isn't it? And so you can just say, don't know. Just don't know. Tomorrow, what's going to happen tomorrow? Don't really know. I can, you know, tomorrow probably this will happen and I'll probably get up in time, go to the morning chanting, and this is my usual routine. But in terms of right now, right now, sitting here, what will happen tomorrow is, all I have to say is, I don't know. There are so many possibilities. So this is direct knowing in the present. The future is the unknown. And so this not knowing then is beginning to use it as experience rather than just react to it by trying to get some kind of feeling of security by holding on to possibilities of the future, and trying to say, I hope this, you know, I'm sure, do you think this will happen? And say, oh yes, it definitely will, everything will, the golden age, the Aquarian age. And I remember here in England, you know, they talk about the greenhouse effect and all that, One time the newspaper said everything's going to get warmer. That sounded rather nice. And then they say, they say, you know, probably England will be like southern France. Well, that sounds all right. I didn't mind that. Then a few days later, they came out with the fact that probably due to global warming, then the Gulf Stream would shift. So actually, we'd end up more like Iceland or Greenland, someplace like that. I didn't like that. That didn't sound very nice. But we don't know, you know, what the Gulf Stream is going to do. So then the past, we don't worry about the past, do we? It's not something, I mean, we can feel guilty, maybe, about things we've done in the past. So we can think that, you know, I shouldn't have said that, I shouldn't have done that. But then we can also worry about the future, like my karma. With Buddhists, we have this law of karma. So we know that because of maybe misbehavior in the past, that in the future we're going to have to pay for it. So then we worry, what will happen? You know, I did this in the past. What do you think will happen to me? And so we speculate about possible scenarios of punishment for bad things done in the past. But we don't know. We know in the past is just memory that arises, and that affects us. So we remember, say, bad things we've done in the past, and because we are sensitive, we are intelligent beings, then that memory will leave its impact on us. It makes us feel, say, if I recollect something unwholesome I've done in the past, then when I remember it now, it brings in the feeling of guilt. I feel guilty about it. So guilt is like this. Now you can, just by observing, witnessing to the way it is, you begin to, say, rest in this state of knowing, of pure awareness, pure intelligence in the present, which is the way out of suffering, is the liberation from suffering. And it sounds paradoxical almost, and think that by actually accepting these things for what they are and knowing them and feeling them, then we think, you know, the mind thinks, well, I'm just going to suffer even more. But that's not the way it really works. The suffering around memory and about the unknown in the future and all that is the resistance, the indulgence, the resistance, the denial, the rejection to all this. It's not when we embrace life, when we fully observe and feel and recognize things for what they are, then we do not create suffering. Even though what we might be feeling is suffering in itself, might be unpleasant in itself, but we're not creating suffering onto that. So it's this stuff that we create, that we produce out of ignorance, out of not understanding things that the Buddha was pointing to. That why we can stop doing this. We have the ability to through mindfulness and through wisdom to not create suffering around the experiences that we're having in the present. And this, of course, takes the willingness to develop this sense of awakened awareness, paying attention and investigation, examination. It's like this. Grief is like this. Guilt feels like this. Now, if I feel guilty about something, then I can rationalize. I can say, oh, you didn't, you know, you didn't, your intention was all right, it was just an accident. I can rationalize myself into dismissing it and thinking, don't be so silly. You know, the past is the past, it's over, just forget it, get on with your life, don't worry about it. Let it go. and still hangs on until you actually examine it. You know. Not analyze it in terms of why, but in terms of what it really is in the present. So like worry in the present is always about the future, isn't it? The unknown, the uncertain, what might happen. So we worry. So worry is, what does it feel like to worry? What is worry like as experience in the present? So then we're changing our attitude. Rather than telling ourselves, oh, don't worry, everything's going to be okay. That's dismissing it, isn't it? Oh, it'll be all right, you know, just don't worry about it, it'll be okay. That's dismissing. Or, getting caught up in just becoming totally overwhelmed with worry, so we can't sleep. We have to take tranquilizers or something to go to sleep because we're so worried about the sky falling in on the future or about whether the England's going to get warm like southern France or cold like Greenland. Or whether it's going to be a third world war. What about the crime rate? What about the drugs? What about the AIDS? What about all the rest? And this, oh, it's something to worry about. So worry then is like this. So when I examine worry, you know, I feel it's like just kind of agitated state. You feel this emotional kind of agitated, irritated state. When you're not following it, either through resisting, denying, or indulging, then and you're fully with the actual feeling and the presence and experience of worry, then it kind of stops naturally because you're not stopping it out of resistance or rejection, but because you're not fueling it, you're not feeding it, you're not believing in it, you're not reacting to it, you're not indulging it, you're not trying to resist it and just get rid of it, because it doesn't run all that deep. It just it's quite superficial to say worry. Or the unknown, you can carry it to a kind of existential dilemma, you know, into something that really, you know, we can make it very important. This worry about the future, some very profound experience. How we can relate? We can dismiss it as just being silly and not worth bothering with, or we can make it into something, you know, very important to our lives. But the actual way of dealing with it isn't by believing in taking this that it's silly and unimportant or that it is, but recognizing it, knowing it, feeling it. And it's like this. So saying it's like this isn't dismissing it, it's really noticing it, what it feels like, the experience of worry, and it like embracing. Or some people say honoring your feelings. I don't feel that much respect for it. Embrace is more my style. But it is this way. But whatever words you use to bring your attention to it and feel it, work. I mean, you have to use what works, helps you to respond to it, to relate to it in a wholesome way, rather than just the old habitual patterns of indulgence or resistance. The spiritual life always implies a realization of the deathless. And so in different religions, of course, they describe it differently, and they have union with God or whatever way you want to phrase it, is not so important as to recognize this as something that we can experience now, realize now. And I think this is particularly what drew me to Buddhism when I was young, was the fact that it emphasized the actual investigation of experience to realize the deathless, which wasn't something that would happen in the future. Where before I was more of the assumption that you'd get enlightened in the future, or you'd get rewarded for being good, or there's always something, you don't know. You better maybe. There's the jokes about people subscribing to all the religions just so that when they die they'll have covered every possibility. And so with Allah or Jesus or Jehovah or whatever, you kind of get all of them just so that everything is who's ever right, you've got it. But in terms of say that's just seeing the religious conventions in a very superficial way. Because you're just giving too much importance to the convention, religious conventions. Because what are they pointing at? You can always, it's like the deathless, or eternal life, or salvation, or liberation. Or these words point to a realization, to reality, which isn't separate. It isn't like it happens to you after you die. And so this is in the Buddhist teaching, he's always pointing to the present, because it's in this present moment that we realize the deathless. And we get beyond just the conditioning of our mind, which is based on time, on the conditioned values and qualities of conditioned phenomena, like the future, the past, and myself. These are all conditions, these are perceptions that we believe in, that we get conditioned by from our culture, and then we oftentimes never even question them. They seem so true, so real. They're what we experience life through. We perceive life through these conditions, and then we experience it like that, according to the way the perception works. The form or the state or the quality or the distortion of the perception. So in meditation, we're getting beyond perception, just perceiving things in this way or that, to this, like, awareness is actually getting, you can actually observe perceptual conditions. It's like, say, not knowing, don't know. You use the perception of not, don't know, or not knowing, which helps you to look and to realize that state of not knowing is like this. So then you're actually, observing the reality of it rather than merely operating from the perception. So I call this intuition, intuitive awareness, where the mind is receptive, open to the experience now, whatever it might be. So at this moment, whatever is affecting us, pleasure, pain, comfort, heat, cold, I mean, many things can be affecting us all at once, like certain parts. We can feel pleasure and pain. You can have a happy thought in your mind and have a pain in your knee. you can have, pleasurable sensory experiences and emotional anguish all at the same moment. So that the moment isn't, that's where when we're caught in just grasping, then we tend to grasp one thing and not see the rest. So like just one little thing, one unhappy memory can dominate the whole day once you grasp it. I remember when I was, before I became a monk, living in Sabah, as in this beautiful tropical place, tropical paradise, on the west coast of Sabah in Borneo. So, and it had this idyllic life, just palm trees, white sand beaches, coral reefs, nice people to live with. Pleasant. We're teaching English to little children, little Chinese children, and a lot of parties, water skiing, snorkeling. I was young, healthy. And I think life isn't going to get any better than this. It's a tropical paradise, dream of being in a tropical paradise where life was just easy and pleasurable. So then I noticed that this was the way it was much of the time, but then one little thing could one unhappy incident could mar the experience of pleasure and everything being all right. Just one kind of sarcastic word or slight or something said that was unkind could ruin my day. Just some little thing could totally ruin my day in a tropical paradise. because the sun was still there, the palm trees, the beautiful water, the coral seas, the birds and the bees, the pleasant people, the good food. First, the only time in my life I've ever had Napoleon brandy was in that. And we could afford it when there's some wealthy people around used to import all these kind of expensive items. So even with Napoleon brandy, you could still suffer endlessly over feeling that somebody was insulted me or hurt my feelings. I began to see that this was how much fear and anxiety I could create around me in situations it seems almost. I could see that it was habit, it was ignorance. But what do you do about it? You didn't want to be that way, didn't like that, didn't want to have to live like that. But what do you do about it? If that's what you're feeling, and how it can, and the more you kind of just resist it, the more kind of stubborn it becomes. You're obsessed. You wake up in the morning and you think, he said this to me. And then my rational mind would say, doesn't really matter, it's his problem, don't you worry about it. But it hurts, it's not fair, it's not right, he shouldn't have said that. I'm not going to let him get away with it. What can I say back? I've got to set him straight. Maybe I won't speak to him. And then, don't be silly, be a man, grow up, don't be so stupid. But then you get this war, between your sensible, rational intellect and your emotions. And so you get, and you end up just being totally confused by it, and ruining the quality of your life. So then in meditation, this kind of problem was addressed. So this battle between, say, your rational intelligence and your emotional habits. And through that you can, that's through this intuitive awareness. Because the mature, intelligent man said, don't be so silly, it's unimportant, don't make anything of it. That's sensible, isn't it? That's reasonable. It's right. It was silly, unimportant. It's really his problem, not mine. And don't make anything of it. And I could convince myself for a while, but on the emotional level, it still felt this way. It still hurt. Felt this feeling of being hurt. So that we can just explain away everything and not really, and in the long run, it doesn't work, because the feeling of life has never been accepted. It's oftentimes just been judged as stupid and unworthy, and you just don't bother with it. So you resist it. You never release it. You never resolve it. So meditation helps us to resolve those things, those little things, those immature reactions, that sense of being frightened or misunderstood or not supported or not being appreciated or being looked down on or being dominated or being patronized, whatever. And so this is where, in the here and now, it feels like this. Now I know how to relate to these kind of emotions. So start worrying, what are we going to do about the, like these steps out here in the entrance? They never finished off the steps. And we've already paid them off, you see. So you don't have anything to hold over them. We shouldn't have paid them. We should have waited till they finished it and then pay them. It's too late now. Every other day I go in the office and say, when are they going to finish off those steps? And this has been going on for months now. And you feel irritated and frustrated. And then they, in the office, they phone the company and they say, oh, we'll do it. We'll do it right away. And then they don't do it. So then I could worry about that. Are they ever going to do it before I die? And then my sense of righteousness, we paid them. They're supposed to finish it. They're supposed to do a good job. It's limestone from Italy. It's Vincenzo limestone, and you paid lots of money to have that done and not finished, and they haven't done it properly, and then you can see you get into this mode of resentment, worry, anger, rage at the workmen or the company, the people responsible. But also, you can look at that feeling, it doesn't mean you don't do anything, but it means you're relating to it in a different way. You're learning from it. You're examining it. You're using the situation not just to make you feel, to get the thing done, get it over with, because that'll make you feel all right, but you're actually using the difficulties, the obstructions, the irritations, frustrations of experience for understanding the way things are and using those things rather than just dismissing, denying, or getting caught up into a way that you actually can have insight into the Dhamma. And as you are more able to do that, then you begin the conditioned realm that we're so much identified with loses its power to delude and control us, and then we realize the deathless. It's a realization. But before we realize the deathless, we need to relate to the conditioned realm in a different way, not just the habitual reactivity of indulgence or suppression, but through wisdom and understanding of it. It's like this. And even when they finish the steps, which Ajahn Atthapema says they definitely will do, and he's usually right, Ajahn Atthapema, so I mean. But and when they do finish, like Ajahn Atthapema says, there'll be something else to worry about. Because that's the way the world is. There's always something not quite right. And you can always make it better. When we first carpeted this floor in here, somebody criticized it. Why did you get a carpet like that? You should have gotten this kind of lino, you know, where you can, because people spill coffee on the carpet and leave stains. But if it's lino, then you can just wipe it up with a sponge. It's true, you know. And many times I felt guilty about this carpet because I'm the one that chose it. And there's this big stain right here. But I don't like lino, you see. But because of that, then I have to suffer these kind of irritations seeing coffee stains on the carpet and can't get them out. So now it's old and, you know, it's been here 5-6 years already, so you don't expect much of it, and it still looks all right. But the first year, I remember just kind of hawk-eyed somebody to watch people, and I'd see... I could hardly bear to come in this room. See somebody taking a cup of coffee and they're saying, Ajahn Sumedho, tell me about mindfulness. And they put it down like that and splat on. In 2 years, we're having July the 4th, 1999, we're having the final ceremony for the temple here. You see that big marble ball out in the courtyard? That will be lowered in the temple, in the middle of the floor there. It's paved over with limestone now, but we'll take that part of that out, and there's a hole there, and then you drop this ball into this hole, and it's a kind of like a ceremony in which it conveys the ending or the kind of finishing touch. The burying of the orb is, I think, a Thai ceremony. And we're hoping the King of Thailand's sister will come and cut the rope. You kind of suspend this beautiful marble, this marble from Scotland, marble ball over this hole, and then as you cover the marble ball with gold leaf, and then the princess will come and she'll cut the rope, and then it'll go plunk, and then you pave over it, you never see it again. So that's something to look forward to, isn't it? But this ceremony will take place in July of 99. You're all invited to watch it. And if you're not being fully alert, you might actually miss the moment. If you're sitting around talking to somebody, the princess comes in, cuts the rope, and drops in, we pave over it, and you've lost it completely. But the thing about this ceremony, 2 years, you know, you've got to invite the king of Thailand's sister. You know, people like that. What do you do with princesses? You know, posh people and VIPs and all that, and important monks. And you've got to provide this and do that. And there's so much to worry about in this ceremony that I could, you know, worry myself into madness by the time that ceremony takes place. But don't worry, I won't. I try to practice what I preach. But it is in the future, isn't it? And everything could go wrong. And, you know, it might be total disaster. But it might, everything might be just ordinary, might not be much of anything. And maybe, you know, nobody will want to watch the ball drop into the hole. So I think that's enough for the formal side, and the tea is now appearing on the servery due to the efficiency of our team, Lada and company. And so I want to invite you all for a cup of tea, and then 15-20 minutes, if you're interested, we can reassemble and have further discussion.